agree on points here. We may be able to finalize this bill today, but it all depends on how we tackle the differences of approach between various stakeholders. But what I'll with there were some proposals arising from concerns from the committee last time when we met, whereby we requested the department to go and address some of those concerns, and we hope that when they come today here, they will have addressed those areas. So I'll allow them to take us through how they have addressed all those kinds of problems, and we'll take it from there.
Thank you, Chair, and thanks to the honourable members. In the last meeting, as the Chair has indicated, the committee requested that we prepare some facts and figures to support some of the changes that were proposed to legislation, in particular around non-compliances, fines, and also the capacity of the inspectorate. So we've prepared some information, and after presentation of that information, we'll look at the bill and the changes that have been effected. And I'm starting off here with a slide that just gives the profile of our mineral sector in South Africa, and we're saying there that mining in South Africa has been the bedrock of South Africa's industrialization since the 1800s, and currently it continues to contribute to GDP directly about 7%, and indirect contribution of 15%, and contributes to employment levels around 500,000 employees in the mining sector. And the market capitalization of mining industry in this country, 30% of the stock exchange. And the country is a major producer of gold, platinum group metals, manganese, coal, and diamond. And just looking at the structure of our mining sector, I mean, we have high risk, large, deep, labor-intensive gold and platinum underground operations. And as you all know, I mean, our gold deposits are very deep, are going fairly deep, and some of the operations are even deepening. I mean, there's an Anglo-Ashanti project that will take mining in this country to almost 4 kilometers underground. That's the structure of our industry, and we have a growing medium risk mechanized base metal and coal mines, and the low risk surface mines, which are increasing in number since the promulgation of the MPRDA in 2004. But the presentation structure really looks at the. We're looking at compensation. In fact, I forgot to cover that. One of the requests from the committee was that we need to come and give an understanding of how the compensation regime works in the country, how is health and safety linked with the different compensation arrangements in the country. And then we'll look at legal sanctions, regulatory capacity, and then the bill. When we look at the compensation, there are two primary acts that deals with compensation for industrial injuries and diseases in the country, or DMOA, which is Occupational Disease in Mines and Works Act. And that act is administered by the Department of Health, and it deals purely with compensation for occupational lung diseases. Nothing else but just occupational lung diseases. And COIDA is Compensation for Occupational Injuries and Disease Act, and it's administered by the Department of Labor. So we can really see there that compensation is administered by other departments, labor and both health. And what we've tried to do here was just to draw the contrast between the two compensation arrangements. When you look at ODIMWA, that is Occupational Disease in Mines and Works Act arrangement, as I said, it deals with occupational lung diseases, and mine employees are entitled to, even ex-miners who are no longer working at mines, are entitled for free benefit medical examination. They can go to health centers, get examined, and to establish whether they qualify for compensation or not. And once it has been established that employees qualify or miners qualify for compensation, under ODIMWA they can only get a lump sum compensation. So it's not a pension arrangement. You just get a lump sum. And the inspectorate really there is involved by taking, they play a role in the risk committee in the Department of Health that establishes how much levies a company is supposed to pay for exposing people to a risk environment, either to risk health, risk environment. COIDA, it's slightly different. It works on what we call a no-fault system. That is, even if an employee was at fault, he still qualified for compensation. And perhaps the fundamental issue with the Act is that it works on a system of trade-offs of rights. Basically, when this Act was written, it's written on the premise that for you to claim for compensation for injuries or diseases, you cede your civil rights. So if you claim the company or you paid compensation, you can't go to court for civil claims against the company. And that's we had a recent test case with that employee with silicosis who took Anglo Ashanti to court, and the court upheld basically what the legislation is saying. And probably the point here being that, I mean, if you look at what that employee was paid, it was around 16,000. And when the matter went to court, he was actually claiming 2.6 million. And the court basically ruled in favor of the company. Just highlighting the points and the fundamental difference in the legislation there. I was referring to a case that went to the High Court recently, where an employee, it's a trade-off of rights. An employee was paid 16,000 for having, suffering from silicosis because of exposures at mines, and went for civil claim of 2.6 million against Anglo Ashanti, and the court basically upheld what the legislation is saying. This piece of legislation, I think, was drafted in 1993, and it's really based on the principle of the workman's compensation system. And that's I think that's the fundamental weakness there. The issue really is the quantum, the compensation amount that people are able to get. And I often made reference in countries where you introduce trade-off of rights in compensation law, that compensation law will ensure that people are paid for suffering, for loss of quality of life. So they are paid substantial monies because you're trading off rights. But what we see here is that the amounts are really pretty low. And then, but the difference between ODIMWA, under COIDA, employees are entitled to a pension payout. Once you have been injured and it's compensatable, you paid an initial lump sum, which is, I think, one third of what you're entitled to, and on a monthly basis you get pension payout. So this is really how the compensation regime works. I think the request for this information came when we spoke about admin fines, because there was a bit of confusion as to whether admin fines are linked to compensation. And admin fines are not compensation, have nothing to do with compensation. It's simply fines that are imposed on mines for non-compliances. And this slide talks to occupational diseases that we experience in the mining industry. And from this slide we can see there are three major illnesses: tuberculosis, silicosis, and noise-induced hearing loss. Tuberculosis being the main illness that is experienced in the industry, followed by noise-induced hearing loss, and then silicosis. What on the left there, it's the information we got from the annual medical report. And on the right, it shows you the diseases that have been certified, which means can be compensated. So that's the sketch. And at the bottom, you have the figures. So that really shows the numbers, which are significantly high. And then the enforcement provisions. I'm leaving compensation. This slide, I'm looking at the different sanctions or enforcement tools that inspectors have at their disposal to ensure compliance at mines. And what I've done here, I've just showed the role of DME and the role of the justice system, where the institutions come into play. For minor breaches, inspectors are empowered in terms of law to give improvement notices, to instruct mines to correct the situation. And in some instances, I mean, these breaches, when you go back, you still find that people haven't corrected. And at that stage, inspectors can issue administrative fines to secure compliance. And then for serious breaches, inspectors can order stoppage of work or even issue a fine. So we can see there that those are different actions that inspectors can take. Now, serious injury and death, you stop the operations, conduct investigations, and depending on what comes out of the investigation, you can also issue a fine, or you may even refer the matter for prosecution, and that's why it also falls under justice. And then death, we that's the current practice. That's exactly what we do. There's been an incident and the place is unsafe, we stop the operations. And then an investigation is conducted, an inquiry, and that inquiry report, once it's finalized, in terms of Section 72, it has to be referred to the Director of Public Prosecution to handle the matter further. So the following slides looks at minor breaches, repeat breaches, and the numbers of what the inspectors have been doing in the past 3 years, 2005, 2006, 2007, 2008, and we've broken it up in terms of regions, and you can see the totals there. These are instructions or improvement notices that have been given to mines for non-compliances, and we can see there's an increase in the actions that inspectors are taking to ensure that there is compliance. And I think when we look at the statistics, particularly for this year, we already noting an improvement in our safety performance. From 1,000 in 2005 and 2006 to 3,000 in 2007 and 2008. And then the administrative fine in the year of 2005 and 2006, the first column is also broken up in terms of regions. When you look at the recommended, the first column, and let me just outline how the fine system works. If an inspector goes to a mine and he finds this repeat non-compliances, they will then recommend a fine. They will say to the principal inspector, we recommend you issue a fine of this amount to this particular employer for these non-compliances. It's recorded. And then the principal inspector will then look at that, check whether it's correct, and if he or she agrees with it, will confirm the fine and says, yes, I agree with it, the mine must pay the fine. Or the principal inspector, if it doesn't agree with it, will set it aside. The law says he can set it aside or confirm it. So the third column there talks to the number of fines that have been set aside. And then the fourth column is the actual amount of the fines that were issued. We see them, Mpumalanga, for example, 540,000 fines issued for that particular year. And then the last column talks to the monies that the department has collected or have been paid from these fines that were issued. And at the bottom is just the totals, and we can see the collection of the fines is very low, and this talks to why we want to amend the section dealing with the fines. 674,000, a collection of only 107. And that's the trend you see in 2006 and 7, 993,000 fines issued, and 566 collected. And if you look at those stars, 50,000 from Western Cape was actually a fine issued in 2005 and 6. So even the collection for 2007, 6 and 7 was drastically low if you look at the amount that was issued. Same thing with 7 and 8. The value of 3.3 million and only 256,000 collected. And the problem really here is that when you issue this fine, the current system, the way it's written in the law, it's got lots of appeal processes. An inspector issue a fine to a principal inspector. Principal inspector says to the mine, pay. The mine will appeal to the principal inspector. If the principal inspector looks at the appeal and says he must pay, the mine appeals to the chief inspector. If the chief inspector says you must pay, they appeal to, they go to the court. So it's a laborious process that will take you 2-3 years just to get a fine paid. And a part of the problem is that the procedure of how you handle this matter is written into the law. And that's why we are seeking to amend the legislation to remove that procedure from the Act and increase the amount of fines that are issued. And then when you look at the stoppage orders, you can generally see that the regions are issuing a lot of stoppage orders where they go to an operation, they find that things are not right, and they stop the whole operation. And on your last column, it talks to the reasons why these fines are issued. Poor thermal conditions, very hot environment, which is tiring to people. And when you're tired, it's easier to make mistakes and really get injured. Dangerous gases, harmful quantities of that, poor ventilation. I'm just looking at some of them. Poor explosive control, unguarded machinery, even poor support. And if you think that over 50% of our fatalities in this country is because of falls of ground. So we can see there that a lot of stoppages are issued because of that. Same here for the other regions. You'll notice for the Cape regions, mainly because it's small operations where they use machines for diamond operations, sand works, often they have police that are unguarded, and those police people got caught on this police and get killed or injured. So the reasons for issuing the fines mainly relate to risk assessment training and non-guarding of moving parts of machines. Limpopo and Mpumalanga and KwaZulu-Natal, more or less the same. We know we have a lot of coal operations there, so it's conveyors, guarding, but also the support being a problem in some of these areas. So these two slides really compares the admin fines to the stoppage orders that inspectors are giving. And we can see there's a bias towards Section 54, stopping operations, because it's much easier, quicker to get the results for inspectors than a much more laborious administrative system with the capacity problem that the inspectors have. So it just gives us an indication and the total values collected over the last 3 years, 107 the first year, second 566, and 256,000 in the third year. The next slide looks at regulatory capacity, because one of the amendments to the Act was seeking to establish the inspector as an organ of state. And the reason that was advanced was a capacity issue. And the committee requested that we need to present the statistics for the committee to understand the real issues and problems there. When we look at 2006, end of 2006, the inspector carried a vacancy of around 38 out of the total number of posts of 310. And many of these posts are mainly in the technical fields, inspectors who are supposed to be out and inspecting sites. 2007, 76 vacancies. Currently, as we speak, we're standing at 92. So the situation is getting worse. And many of these, 82 of these 92, it's inspectors who are supposed to be visiting places, checking non-compliance and taking the necessary action. No, this is the vacancies. It's the posts in the establishment, in the whole province. And then this slide shows that in the past 27 months, I mean, we've advertised 283 posts, and that has cost the department 3.2 million just for adverts. And then when you look at mining inspectors, 84 vacancies have been advertised, only 31 were filled, and 20 of them are still vacant now. Mine inspectors do. Mine equipment, much more acute, 107 have been advertised, only 16 were filled, 29 still vacant. And the numbers may not match there, because some of these posts you advertise, you don't get people, you re-advertise. So that's what we've been doing, 107 and only 16 filled. And mine equipment is a... Which ones, 107? No. Oh. We advertise basically 84 times.
Oh, 84 times.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
84.
So just 84.
Okay. Then the mine equipment is a big worry. I must highlight, because there are certain statutory inspections that need to be done every 6 months. A machinery inspector needs to go look at the ropes, look at the shaft establishment. And to make sure that things are right. And basically, when you don't have those inspectors, it means those statutory inspections cannot be done. And in the end, you end up with rope failures or failure in shaft, which can endanger lives. Mine surveys, 7 posts advertised, none filled, nothing filled, 7 still vacant. Occupational medicine, 5 advertised, 5 filled. Occupational hygiene, 26. and 21 filled. So in general, when you look at health, not much of a problem, but engineering and survey, a very big problem. People moving back into the sector. So what we've been doing, we've been trying to even appoint people on contract and train them to qualify them as inspectors. That's what you see at the bottom. And we were doing two-year contracts because in the past we appointed people in the establishment and say you need to get your qualification, we pay for their training. But once they are employed permanently, nothing motivates them to get their qualification. I mean, we have some people who've been in the establishment for the past 10 years and they're not qualified to do the full work that an inspector is supposed to do. So we said 2 years. We put you in an academy. When you qualify, you are able to be appointed. But because it's a short period, when people get opportunities somewhere, they quickly run there than to stay in a two-year program where they don't know whether they will have permanent employment afterwards. So these are the same figures, just in percentages, to show the different disciplines, what percentage were we able to fill and what we couldn't fill. This slide is a report that the Human Resource Branch prepares for the Minister and DG quarterly, because every person who's resigning gets interviewed so that we understand why people are leaving. And these are the reasons that that people have advanced. 42% of our staff that is leaving are saying it's because of salaries and benefits. 27% are saying poor management, lack of career path, 26%, lack of recognition, working conditions, and no opportunities for decision making. So really those are broadly the reasons that people are advancing, why they're leaving their employ in the public service. This slide captures what we're doing, because often committee has said, you come here and you tell us your problems, what are you doing? We have a human resource development plan as an inspectorate. Director General saw the need, he said, you're losing people, what can we do? We need a human resource strategy to deal with a problem. So it was developed, three levels of intervention, where we said, we start at the bursary level, because part of the problem with the inspectorate is that when you look at gender and equity also, you don't get many female engineers. The few that are there are needed, so industry sort of takes them. So we thought if we start with a bursary scheme, you are able to make it much more biased, get more female trainees, get them into universities, and grow them through the system. So we approached National Treasury, and they gave us $500,000, which allowed us to get only about 8. I see the slide says 7, but we started off with 8 who are currently at universities studying to come in. But I must highlight that this is a very risky approach. I mean, if you start somebody at first year with so much limited numbers, there's no certainty that they will complete. That's the program, at least, that we have. And then the second level, that's where we call it learnership. Basically, you take people with graduates, with diploma or graduates, and then we put them in an academy. We have an agreement with Goldfields Academy to train them, to give them 2 years experience. At a mine, and once they've completed, we are able to absorb them into a structure. And currently we have 23 learners at Goldfields who are in the process and learning, 19 of them in the engineering, because that's where we have a big shortage, and then a few in survey and occupational hygiene. And then the third level is training and development, generally for the inspectorate, because when you look at South Africa, we don't really train people to become inspectors. You employ somebody who has keep a store for yesterday, and you make him a regulator tomorrow. And inspectors carry a lot of powers and responsibilities, and they need to exercise them with proper understanding of the implication of the decisions they make. And we thought we need to develop that program. And currently we're working with MQA and Vest University to develop that program that would prepare people to do inspection work. We also work with SAMDI for management development, because a lot of people we use come from technical streams and management competence, not necessarily their strengths, and you need to develop them so that when they engage with people and also manage junior officials, mentor them, at least they are able to do all those things. So that was the information that the committee requested, which we came and presented. And I think at this stage, if Chair, if there are no questions, we could probably then turn to the bill and just go through the points.
Thank you very much for the enlightening presentation. I think you have covered a significant part of what were members' concerns. But let's hear what members say about this now, your responses to their last input. Honorable members, I've got the presentation now here, as you requested. Let's see what you want to add now. I've got the hand here from Honorable Kekane, Matibela, Mahlaba, in that order, three of you so far.
In your introductory background, you say that mining contributes 7% to GDP. I'm raising this because, you know, in my own mind, you're hearing so many things that mining is declining and so on and so forth. But 7% is rather too low, because in New Agenda, which is a parliamentary journal edited by Professor Ben Turok, with an interview with the minister, he says it is 30%. I'm just saying the difference is so huge. He says 30% in an interview with the Minister of Mineral and Energy, and he says 7%. I just want to hear your response. That who is speaking?
Yeah.
I think just.
Thank you, Chairperson. And thank you for the presentation. I was looking at the compensation part of it. Do you feel that you are doing your work freely? Because I see the on slide number, your slides are not numbered, but on page 3, on the compensation part, where something has got to go to labor and something to health, Department of Health. So is it not disturbing the mining health inspector by having, you don't know, at times I'm sure you don't know where you are supposed to do, what you are supposed to do or where you are supposed to send. That's my question. And on the enforcement, when you talk about here the fines, I see there are other parts where it goes to justice and the other part is only for DME. Why is it like that? If they don't comply, do you stop there or do you leave them to proceed? I don't know. The other part, the last, the regulatory capacity, because I heard you were saying that people are leaving and finding that it's because they don't have enough. They are not. Their role is not quite recognized because they are taking very little of their part, playing a part, a very little part of being a decision maker in the decision making part. The last one is about the training. You were saying that now here at the last, the training development part, that these people are growing there. But firstly, in the other slide, I don't remember which one it was, that people were leaving because of the salary, even if they are trained in. So this one, with the training that they grow there, don't you think it's also a risk to leave them there, to train them, and then after training, and then sometimes they will leave? Is there anything that they are contracting to say so many years or so many months you have to be there? Thank you, Chair.
Chairperson, thank you very much. I think one needs to applaud the department for some of what I would see as increased efforts. If you look on page 4, under the improvement notices issued, there is an increase, which means there is application of the law. If you go to the number of administrative fines, there is improvement. And if you go to stoppage orders, there's a huge improvement. Now, the question is, if you look at these improvements, they are over the three-year period. If you start from 2005 and 6, then 6 and 7 and 7 and 8. In 7 and 8, it's even better than the two previous years. Is it because they've had increased numbers of inspectors, or is it because of the quality of work, or maybe it's a supervision, because you may have the inspectors, but the inspectors should also be supervised? Where could it be that the department is doing well? Is it because maybe they've employed more and so on? I would like to hear from that one first. But the other one is, probably, is it possible that you can tell us as to what could be the causes? If you look at page 5, a number of recommended administrative fines were set aside. I understand they could have been set aside from different angles. It could be from your office. It could be from your at a lower level, where if the inspector had issued that one and it's set aside within the department's own processes. Some could be set aside at magistrate level or at justice level. What could be the contributing factors? Is it poor investigations or poor sight of using the policy? I'm looking at, if you've got 43 set aside, the value of that 43 could be almost R1 million. And if you look at the amount of time that has been spent issuing those administrative fines, and if you look there, you issued 54 in 2006 and 7, 43 were set aside. That means only 11 went through. I'm just worried as to what could be the analysis and the contributing factor. I think that those were... Okay, the last one is on page 9. I wish to know as well about how much could be the cost to advertise just a batch of posts. If we spend 3.2 million rands over 27 months, which is just a little bit less than 3 years, I've been calculating here, it tells me that it could be almost advertising 4 times a month. But I also want to know as to whether is this trend still continuing right now. I know that we're not dealing with an annual report here, but some of these things we may lose the opportunity of asking them here and we lose sight of them later on in an annual report. But I just wanted to check, is it still going on? Because it shouldn't be a matter of I want to prove to them that I've advertised enough and I couldn't get the applicants or the right people. But it can help us to find that we use so much money on adverts. Maybe one post is advertised 30 times. Is it helping to advertise? Is it not possible for us to see that, no, we couldn't find? I can understand that during the beginning of the year when people have passed at the previous year, you may advertise. Maybe towards the end of the year you can advertise. But I'm just worried that if we'll just constantly keep on advertising, maybe your budget, I'm not sure how much is your budget just for advertising, just for the posts alone. I know that it's posts and equipment and so on. Whether you would still, do you still find that you can still encourage it, that this could still be the picture in the next 2 years, calculating from this year and the next year and the other year? You may come and say, now it's 6 million. Thank you, Chair.
Is there no one who wishes to add that side? Honorable Law?
This is one very difficult issue when we in fact discuss the issue of vacancies, especially in the mining industry. I know for a fact, I've been here in this committee, that they've been struggling to get hold of it. And if you hear that people have left the department, don't be surprised, because it is a reality. One example, one senior director who was sitting here last week, where Mr. Ghazi sat, left the department. Last week, he was sitting there. He left the department, he resigned. You see, it is about money. They get quite a lot of remuneration and packages outside. We understand that. But Chairperson, I in fact want to come to page 3. Comrade Frida raised these issues which are of concern. And I did ask the director to in fact to repeat what he said when I've heard him saying that an employee sued the company for 2 something million and he was only compensated 16,000. Now, comrades, honorable members, what the companies use is they use the law. It means they blame us, and we must unbundle that knot. Can we really look at it? Because it is not right if people get hurt, lose their certain part, arm or leg or something, and he is dependent, his family is dependent on him, and then he only gets 16,000. Otherwise, then he must go and ask Zola's department for a monthly pension. So can we really look at it? How best can we restructure that so that we are in a win-win situation? Not win and lose situation, because our people are losing it. And the companies, the stock exchange is just spiraling, and the shares are just increasing. But I want to appeal to you, Chairperson, and the department. Can we create a situation here where we are in a win-win situation, not a win-lose situation? That is my honest plea. Thank you.
Thank you, honorable member. Yeah, I think I just want to stress your point. Yeah, it's a very important point that you've raised. I think we must agree here before we move to finalize this act that what Comrade, what Honorable Semlo is saying, we have captured it. We know how it has been captured to address exactly this problem of, like you also were saying, this bureaucracy of 3 years, people not appealing. We must just, these are the points which you must deal with here. We must make it a point here that we agree in the session how they are going to be dealt with once and for all. We must agree with it. I just want also to add another input from Honorable Mashaba, which says that you know, if we can spend more than $3 billion just for advertising, fruitlessly, by the way, because it shows, the results show that there has not been any fruitful exercise except it's a tip of an iceberg. I'm just thinking that you have just been crying about the problem of skills development, and it's very related, therefore, even to the adverts, that you do not get the feedback that you expect, although having used so much of money. And I was just thinking that if that money, this $3 million, could have been budgeted actually to send people to training, to school, instead of, you know, if you take this if you go to Treasury and Treasury only gives you $500,000, when you have spent, like, when you have money to spend of the level of more than $3 million to advertise for skills, instead of using that $3 million to upgrade skills, it doesn't make sense to me, you see. Which means to me that there is some money which could be used to do fruitful training and skills development. And I think we have to deal with that situation also here. What should be done? Because where that money, the pool from where that money comes from, it seems to suggest that there is a pool which is reserved for something, and can that pool be used for skills development and training? I just want to hear from you in the case about the pool that exists from which you can advertise and draw such money for advert, which exercise becomes fruitless at the end. And again, then I want also to stress one member's point here. I think I can't remember which is, but I think it was much better about compensation. You have said that the COIDA in particular, it's based on the old workman's compensation. I think that is also what we need to change here. We have to deal with this now so that it suits our new situation. I think these are the things that I've just picked up so far, which we need to deal with here and be sure that we have addressed them. The honorable two members also want to add. I've got Kekania and Masha.
The issue of compensation as raised by Mama Thibela and Sam also is something worth emphasizing. Because remember, under capitalism, the riches of the country goes to owners, basically. Now, the battle that we are having, we're trying all kind of means, given the framework of capitalism, to redistribute to our own people. When an opportunity arises, unfortunately, in a devastating way, because somebody loses his leg or so, we mustn't lose the opportunity to bring the money from up there down to our people. And indeed, if somebody is in an accident there and he loses his leg, he only gets 15,000. You can imagine how much the owners of that company get in their safe offices, how much they get when they do dividends. So the point is, it is for us. I mean, this is redistribution under capitalism. The best we can do is to fight such that our people get what we couldn't distribute under normal conditions. So I'm just saying that this is one area where we mustn't hesitate. When we get the opportunity and reach our people, make sure that this goes down. This poor guy can now feed his family, can take his children to school, he can have a decent house. Thanks. I was just emphasizing that point and saying it is our only opportunity to really make sure that resources come down from the top to the people down there.
So. Now, Chairperson, I think I'm on the last slide, which was about training and development plan. I think the plan is telling us that with the situation of the adverts that have been done and so on, there's a great deal of improvement that we need to do there. In terms of training, because we're all aware, as we are told, that we cannot find readily available skills in the open. And that's why there's a need to do your own training and prepare your own people that you are going to appoint. I think it's also important, I've just heard that some people come in between they leave. I think I'm not sure what are the conditions of engagement. If you take somebody on a two-year program and in between he leaves because of certain reasons, there should be something contractual gaps that are closed. Because if somebody is committed and say he comes in and in between he runs away, you've already spent money. There should be something that will force the person to go through the program, and if the person do well, that person should feel assured that he or she will get a post in the department. But my worry is the numbers are too low against a huge demand, of which on the other hand we all know if all the departments can do like this, but in bigger scale, it could help the rest of the industry, because you might be saying you're training for yourself, but the person after the 2 years or whatever program, he'll be there for a year and then he leaves. But immediately you've got a bigger number around, movement will be limited because we'll be having enough skills. There will be a little bit of competition for fewer posts rather than having less people and more posts. Thank you.
Yeah, I think another question we have to deal with here is the legacy of apartheid. You see, in the mining industry, that legacy is very well and alive. You see, when we once visited the Council for Geoscience, we were surprised what we saw. And I think the committee has to take some oversight talk over this mining industry. Because you see, it's one thing to listen to the delegation here. They are very senior officials of the department. They have a small taste of what is happening, and they are trying to relate that insofar as they are affected. But you see, there is a lot there. You see, we went to the Council of Geoscience one time when they appointed the new CEO. And initially, when we first came there, he was very recently appointed. And when we were taken around, there was almost, it was just a very old white establishment against him and his immediate black human resource manager. But surprisingly, some months later when we went there, the CEO who was the former CEO was taking him through on a transitionary arrangement. He had left, and what he told us was very, very, very disturbing. He had left with everything that was a support system to that CEO. He had left with his secretary, his PA, who was managing his computer things, all that went off, all the programs that were there to assist the CEO in everything. The secretary was supposed to be, the executive secretary was supposed to be the support system to the new CEO, had also been resigned. The deputy also, and with the secretary, also resigned, and they also wiped off all the information. It was a real nightmare. So I'm simply saying, therefore, that that shows, now these are the people who are supposed to be in the executive management of mines. Now, if we have that attitude, how much more to the people that you are trying to defend, the workers? If the CEO level type or yourselves as chief inspector, you are also put under such pressure because of the legacy of apartheid. And I was listening today, this morning, to these new morning argument shows, debates. They were talking about the racialization of our economy. They were saying that it doesn't only add an economy, the whole infrastructure, including the media itself, it is racialized, because it will not follow cases of people who have been pulled by or have been put into lion's dens. It will just say one day, and it will not follow them up because it is not in their interest, because themselves they are racialized, you see. So I think there is a legacy here which the size of which is very bigger than what we think we're dealing with. But at least if we can pin together some piece of legislation to assist and bundle this kind of racial backlog, it can help us. And part of what we're talking about is what the members have said, that, for instance, let us put together some pieces of legislation here to help us, for instance, about compensation, for instance, about bureaucracy of payment of fines, for instance, the sophistication of the legal aspects, manipulating the situations in terms of law. Let's close all those gaps here. It will assist us, but it won't solve the problem, but at least it can assist us. But we are dealing here, I want us to have a bigger picture, that we are dealing with a very big challenge than we think we can solve. The question of skill itself is a problem. You see, the skill, you see, we need to have, I think one of the things that you need to do is to have roadshows. Go to universities, go to schools, go to institutions, and try and recruit. It is not without a challenge in itself. It is with a challenge. But also, the challenge is also not there. It is also within our establishment themselves, the attitudes that we have. When our executives, if they would like to, that we can employ at random as we wish, because, again, that is a problem. We come from that experience ourselves. That's why we're here in Parliament. So I am trying to say that the question is bigger than we think, but we can assist it by legislating some pieces of clauses here that at least help us. And I think the members have identified some of them here. And I think that is what we must agree about. I'll give you therefore to respond.
I've noted the number of questions. Honorable Kekana raised the question on the percentages of contribution of the mining sector to GDP. I must check my references. We certainly look statements and comments probably that the minister was making, whether it was combined, because often in some areas it's split between direct and indirect, and sometimes people talk about overall contribution. But it's certainly something we can look at and just verify the figures. We don't deal with it, we just get it from the latest journals. Ms. Babuseng, I think will assist us just on the question around compensation, and Mr. Gagarin will help us with the justice and DME question, why some of the questions issues are handled only in DME and not the justice. And just looking at the resignation, there was a Honorable Matibela asked a question about the resignations and the reasons that people are advising. Our presentation was really just sharing information, facts and figures. And as the questions were coming, I wasn't sure how we're going to handle it, because it was purely just for information and supporting the legislative changes that we are making. But those are reasons that people are advancing, and I've just put them as is. That's the report that was submitted to the minister. And then around training, there was a question as to whether is there no risk that we're training people and they will leave. There's always that risk. I mean, when Minister Maduna was the Minister of Minerals and Energy, at that time a program was started where we took 50 learners through training, and currently we only have 3 of them. The rest, once they qualify, 3. So currently what we're doing, the current ones, we've entered the contract with them to say, we train you for 2 years, and so you'll work for us for 2 years. If they leave, then they will have to pay back all the money we've spent on them. So we have that sort of arrangement, just to make sure that at least we are able to get value out of them. And then Honorable Masaba raised the question around increase in enforcement, whether it's have we appointed more inspectors. I think the slide I showed on regulatory capacity, it couldn't be that we appointed more inspectors, because the figures were just increasing of vacancies. So it's very clear that we didn't appoint more inspectors, but yes, just improving management controls, improving efficiencies, and also highlighting the need to apply the legislative tools that are there. I think in one of our quarterly meetings last year, we spoke about these issues, and the regions raised their concerns, and we said system is not working, but it's there, you have to apply it. Later when the legislation is reviewed, we have to correct the shortcomings, but you cannot not apply the law, because it's problematic. And probably that's the result of what you see. You noted in 2007 and 8 there's an increase in fines, because effectively if somebody went there, the report says he observed something wrong, the managers are expected to ask, why didn't you take the necessary action? So yes, there's improvement in supervision, and just making sure that we do not allow a non-compliance, because we believe even when we strain for resources, with improving efficiencies, you can still make an impact, and that's really our approach currently. Say the limited resources we have, let's plow them efficiently and see whether we can't make a bit of improvement. And then the advert amounts, the last figure I had, and stand corrected, I mean, this is managed by human resources, and it differs from paper to paper, where you advertise. And placing an advert, normally we put them in a group to save money, but the figure I had was about 7,000 for one advert on a weekend paper. So we conglomerate them and advertise them. And there were a lot of questions around the advert. observation I'd like to make, I mean, the public sector, when you budget, there are line items. If you budgeted for advert, that's money for advert. You can't just move money and reprioritize. We've tried to do that. This program that we're doing, we had to put a request to say we have vacancies. Can't we use some of those money for training? But remember, PFMA only limits the department to use a certain amount, I think 8% at the level of DG. You can't go beyond that. So there are clear structures established by other legislation. And the point I often advance is that, and that was part of our motivation when we said we need to establish an inspector as an entity, because our view is that we need to invest in skills and training. That we have to do in numbers. But currently, with that limitation, you can only take a certain number with the resources that are available. And adverts, I think Minister of Public Service made a point that it was actually in the President address of the nation the beginning of the year, that we need to fill posts in the public sector. And effectively, if you're not filling posts, there were clear directives that if you're not advertising, those posts will be taken because you don't need them. So effectively, even when we're not getting, we advertise with the hope that we will get. The public sector framework forces us into that mode of doing what we're doing there. And then in it, we'll deal with the compensation, Gaga, and then Shelley with setting aside of fines.
You said you need to, if you don't advertise, you are penalized.
I mean, directives are out that if you have a post and for the past 3 months you haven't advertised it, then you don't need it. So those monies will be allocated in other areas. And we know we need the post. The problem is getting the skilled people. So if you don't advertise, you even run in the risk of losing the post, and then you won't have the establishment.
Yeah. But how are they going to be allocated to other areas? Because you just said that PSMA doesn't allow that it should be, that money could be used for another thing.
Chair, I don't know, but those are the directives that we... The post, not the money, the post. The post will be given to other units.
What GMFA is saying around, you change, you use the money.
Firemen.
It's firemen. So you deal with firemen. So, but equally, if you don't use the money, you see, because of a good reason, I don't think the rule is. It's so strict that it can't give you a chance, because the country as a whole has a problem of skills. All the technical skills in the country around your engineering and everything, it's a big problem. So there should be some effort in making sure that there is an amount, a dedicated amount of budget to be used. The other advanced countries of the world, they use some percentages, you see, in terms of your total budget, they say 1.5% will be used for skill development. Okay. So we don't, I don't know if South Africa has that, but everywhere you go, the lack of doing this and implementation is, the excuse goes back to the question of skills, whereas we take time to introduce laws, and those laws create hope, possibilities of big changes. I'm going to find that we far lag behind because we can't really realize those laws. So I think there should be, especially a department like DME, it has to give its utmost focus and concentration on this issues around skills, you know.
Yeah, I was just about to find out really why has the department not put aside, because it's not a question of only now. I mean, since I came to Parliament, department has been coming here saying that they are running short of skills. Why have they not budgeted for skills ever since?
Chair, the point raised by the honourable member, that's the case. I think the department set about 2% of the payroll for training. I think the last E&E document shows that it's 5.4 million. But really the challenge is that it's not for one branch. It's a departmental. So there are a lot of competing priorities. And there are problems in many areas, in the energy, in the nuclear. But certainly they are set aside.
But aren't those monies set aside according to various divisions of the department? That this is, mining has got, it's supposed to be the priority of the department because it is the center of economy in any event. And it is where we are running short. Why would the department not make put a budget, put your division as a priority division for skills development, and therefore percentages, honorable Naring saying that we allocate this percentage for you, looking at, analyze, audit the department and the skills shortage, and then budget accordingly. Why would they not do that? And if they don't do that, why you as the head of this division would not go and challenge them? I'm not talking about now, over all these years, because this has been a problem over these years. Why have you not challenged them? Or why have you not put it at the forefront of departmental internal budgeting?
The last portion, Chair, I think it's easier to deal with. I think to a greater degree as a branch, we've challenged the establishment. I mean, our training programs run to close around 5 million, which is the entire budget of the department. That to run that program with 24 learners, the university learners already, we've running almost the entire training budget of the department just in one component, and probably that's the challenge of increasing it even more. But I think the first portion, I'll make a note of it. I think when we come as a department, I'll make a note from Guni to address the questions around the budget training and how as a whole department we need to deal with it.
Last time we did raise this issue, about, you know, when we read that KISA and it tells us at national level for this guy skills, WIBAN, former WIBAN now disturbing me. No, I was just saying, when we read that case of the reviewed economic policy, after identifying skills such as with GIPSA, it is said that at national level, a skills such as task team has been established, which collaborates with South African Engineering Council, and which is led by Deputy President. And the point I'm making is, you know, when departments come to us and they just speak with their programs and they don't relate to the national program. I mean, the normal thing is indeed you do have your own skills training in human resource, but the other point is we'd like to see how you interact with national and whether national is fitting into the whole departmental programs and departmental programs are interacting with national programs. I did ask this question that it would be nice when you come next time if you could say to us through DG, you have interacted with that program because they said they are training engineers they are building this engineering that we need 1,000, and they think they can produce 2,000 a year. And that is engineers, technicians, and artists. I mean, otherwise you'll have programs and programs, and they are just on paper, and we as a nation, we don't implement those programs. So I would request that when you come next time, we don't just want to hear about what you are doing, but that national program, is it fitting into you? Go and say, this is our needs. What percentage of these needs can you meet while we're doing our own training? I'm requesting that next time, if we could get a report of whether you fit acted nationally that program. It is very nice, Kisa.
I will address the question that was raised by Honorable Mashaba around the setting aside of admin fines and what could be the contributing factors to set aside the admin fines. As Mr. Gazi had explained, the process when he was doing the presentation, it is set at different levels, but it doesn't get to a level of the court, or it does get to the level of the court. The inspector, once recommending to the principal inspector within the regional setup, the principal inspector will look at the reasons advanced by the inspector and request the mine to give representation why should it not be fined. And based on looking at those two, we'll decide whether to impose or not. But once it's imposed, then the mines will have to either pay or appeal to the chief inspector of mines. Now, that's a different set of documents that are sent to head office. We have to look at them, look at the reasons advanced by the inspector and the reasons advanced by the employer. Now, the biggest problem that we have is the Act itself does prescribe what is it that we need to consider in setting aside the fine or in finding the employer. Section 55E, as it currently reads, it says we must make a determination on the basis of those documents that the employer was negligent or not negligent in not complying with the Act at that stage. And if we find it cannot be established by the documents submitted by the inspector that the employer was negligent in not complying with the Act, then we cannot, the appeal cannot, the fine cannot be imposed. Now, those are limitations that we have within the Act, and we operate within the framework and the provisions of the Act, and it becomes rather difficult to go outside what is provided for in the Act. And those are the factors that influence the setting and not setting aside of the Act. Now, we also have another piece of legislation, which is the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act, which at the level of the chief inspector, the presentations will indicate that we did not give them enough reasons, an opportunity to provide us with reasons. And then if we do, on most of the appeals that we do at that stage, advise that no, we are confirming them, then it's elevated to the labor court. Now, most of them are at this stage also at the labor court, where they're raising issues of procedural issues in terms of PASA, which we also cannot escape as the department. We are also bound by that in terms of administrative acts that we act. So this whole administrative process is rather very laborious and very cumbersome, and we are tied not only by the Mine Health and Safety Act but also other pieces of legislation. And we also are dependent on the documents. We can only make a ruling on the documents that is presented to us. Now, it is rather very difficult to prove negligence on the employer, because they would bring, say, for example, it's a question of whether the employee was trained or not trained. They would bring the training manuals and all of these things, an indication that we trained them, and then the employer says, the inspector says, no, the employee was not trained. Now, how do you prove determined negligence there? And if the Act already says if you cannot establish negligence at that stage, you cannot impose the fine. Now, those are one of the issues that we're trying to address through the amendment to take out those sections that are impeding the enforcement of health and safety.
Follow-up is that I want to know if those impediments in this Act, are we addressing them? When we deal with the bill, are we going to get solutions so as to clean out laborious processes and obstacles, and making sure that we, this time we don't inconvenience ourselves, because it's useless and foolhardy for people to sit down and draft a law which will work against them. Are we addressing?
think this response is bringing us back to the amendment that has been brought forward to say that the employers now need to submit records of their training. I can't remember how it has been put, but I think sometimes for somebody to bring a document which does not necessarily prove that a person was trained is a question on its own, unless we are briefed as what is really that you're going to be getting. Because it says that they need to provide, I'm not sure if you're saying records, what are you expecting? Attendance register signed by each employee who was trained, or just the list of training that was done? I think it needs to be unpacked so that we know that we won't be coming back some other time to say, now there's another loophole. We find that there are employees who are alleged to have not been trained, but we have given the list of training that was provided. That's why we even brought up the issue of formal and informal. That if somebody will do an informal training and we say it was formal, we need to know the list of what are the critical training of which I now understand it was provided. But this specific one that I'm checking is important then, so that we know that we don't provide an amendment which is still going to be open to misuse.
I think that is clear, that we must unpack even that training. We must be specific that there must be proof. It shouldn't. They may show a list of their programs of training, that these are the records of training that you offer here, but they do not necessarily attach their training to any specific person. I've got an example, a very, very sensitive example, I think I won't use it, but there is a company here which, when it wanted monies from the state, it said that part of it is because it is training employees. And then it used to take employees overseas for tours, and then it would record that those tours were trainings. And I remember one time where employees went to Russia, and they stayed in the hotel for a week, and they were taken around tours of Russia. And they came back, and it was recorded as training. And so then when they asked, they said, so when we asked, what training did you? I said, no, we were just in the hotel. We went around and see the mountains, and and then we came back, I see. But it was recorded that we had our employees there. Some have been trained overseas. We've taken them overseas and so forth and so on. I'm trying to say that we are aware of some of these things. And therefore, when we knit up a piece of legislation, we have to knit it up and know that these are the loopholes that are used. People have got all types of techniques how to abuse the state monies or taxpayers' monies in the name of advancing the cause of the state when actually they are advancing their individual causes. So I'm very we have to be sure what we say in terms of those records of training, just as we have to also know what we want to say in terms of closing those gaps about the bureaucracy of funds. We have to be very specific so that they can't, technical legal experts can't twist us around. And I think we have to be very, we've got to be very focused when we come to that. I do not know how we're going to do it, because we have to do it here. We have to be sure when you leave that this thing. We don't want to just, you see, there are technicalities even here in Parliament. That we discuss like this, we agree, and you go that I were going to do it. But somewhere outside, you don't do it exactly as you wanted. And then at the tight time when we're supposed to present the bill in Parliament, we found that actually some of those things were not done in the way we're supposed to do. And now there's no time. And then we have to pass the bill with knowing very well that it has got the gaps that we had said should be closed. At one stage, I'll always quote this speech because it's very recent. At one stage, my name has been used that because we caught it at the time when we were supposed to go and present it that afternoon. Now, there are rules of Parliament. Once it has been tabled for debate, there's nothing you can do. You have this, you want to make any changes, you have, it's a whole lot of everything. We've got to apply to the Speaker, give the Speaker 24 hours to decide whether she allows that amendment. And therefore, you must also, in doing that, you must form a quorum and agree as a committee which has formed a quorum that you are now going to apply to the Speaker and so forth. So the whole lot, then it looks very clumsy and bad even to the House to come at the last moment and say, after all the time you're processing this legislation as a committee, you didn't know what you were doing on the last moment to go and change before the House. It doesn't look good. And so that is why I've said that we are not going to rush this piece of legislation when we do not know that you have done exactly what you have said. And I know that I as a chairperson become under pressure from my members of the committee who want that, no, we must finalize this thing now. And then if we finalize it now, there are all these gaps that we are supposed to check if they have been done. And then you'll stay here with us and go and say, no, we'll do it. Probably not necessarily that you didn't want to do it. Technically, probably, the person who does it makes errors and doesn't do it exactly as you wanted. And all of a sudden now, you come here, we have already passed it here as a forum. It's very difficult to get Honorable Lucas back from Japan here to come and form another quorum that testing was not done like we had hoped, you see. So that is why, therefore, I would not like now, because my name has been used at the first stage there, that I came with amendments that came from me, even in fact they came from this committee, because I had to dictate those amendments before the House, according to the rules of Parliament. So I had, as a chair, to go and say, no, this is, we are amending, we request for amendment like this and this and this and this and that. Now, the members of the department went to NSOP and said, those amendments are not known. Chair just woke up and then dictated them there. And so I have my name looked. Then I have been known by NSOP that I am a dictator. I do not consult with the committee. I simply wake up when I step the other side and give dictation and just announce changes in the whole legislation. It's a very bad thing. So I don't want to be in that situation now. So I want us, members have raised very critical questions, and you have agreed, members of the department are great, exactly like we are agreeing, but at the end they didn't do it, because it was only a 24-hour issue. The following day, we were supposed to debate the issue, we found that they have not done that, and then I was in problems. So I don't want us to have that problem today. So we must agree that you go and change those legislation, and we see them when we still form a quorum, that indeed it's what we know. And then they took the bill, because the bill was there, and those amendments, I dictated them from the paper, because they had not put them in the bill. Then they went to NSOP and they said, look at the bill, you look at what it is. They went even to fetch records of answered what I talked. They pointed and said, look what he talked, it's not what is in this bill. So I was really a dictator. So I want us to be very clear that these amendments must be done when we are still here together.
Thank you, Chair. I'll respond to the question of enforcement, where some of the actions are not taken to the Justice Department and some are with the Justice Department. It's related to the slide with enforcement provision. This is what we have been trying to explain all the time that we have been here. In as far as that the department only deals with the non-compliance. That's where our jurisdiction ends. And then whenever there is a contravention and an offense is created, it goes to the court. So it is the non-compliance issues, because we have the expertise, the inspectors go there, they see the non-compliance, and then they issue the fines or the stoppages. That is as far as we has the power. But whenever there is any contravention that creates an offense, it is dealt with by the court. So that is why you see the gaps, some of the breaches that are not taken. That is all.
Now the principal has gone out. I don't know what is the way forward. Yeah.
I thought the way forward would be who is going to lead the.
Are you responding?
I was going.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I just want to add to one of the point that was raised by Mr. Ghazi, that is, and the point with regard to the people or candidates that have been trained by the department who have been made to sign contracts, because he said that we with the current trainees, we are making them to sign a contract for about 2 years. But I just want to say something there that it's still a challenge and a concern to us, because though they sign maybe a 2 year contract and that if at all they don't complete it, then they are going to pay X amount of money. When it comes to the industry, really, that is nothing, you know, because, I mean, they just take them and we remain without. I just want to mention, for example, an instance where one employee, one person of, you know, in that particular category, an engineer, we trained him for about 4 years. And then just after he got his, before he even received his certificate, you know, the GCC, which is the government certificate, they sacked him and off he was. And they said that they were not even worried, whatever amount of money it is, no, we'll just pay it and it means nothing. So with that, I'm saying that, Chairperson, maybe we need to look also into that, you know, the money as to how much. It shouldn't be nothing, because it's absolutely nothing. It means nothing for the industry. And then, Chairperson, before I come to my issue, which is the issue that deals with compensation, I also want to say something, because Honorable Committee Member Masaba said something around the improvement that he observed with regard to our operations, from enforcement, notices, admin fines, etc., etc. And he wanted to, for example, the reasons as to why could there have been an improvement. Was it as a result of supervision, or could it perhaps have been, and because when what we hear and what we are presenting here, we are saying that capacity, you know, is very, very low. Chairperson, I think that I would say that to me, I think actually it has to do with supervision, and I think it has to do actually even with a focus that we've got guidance to say where are we going to, what is it actually that we want to achieve. So in answering that one, that question around what could the reason be, though it is not necessary, I wouldn't say that actually it is capacity, but I think that though we are in numbers actually, if we think that we had so many inspectors earlier and we were doing very, you know, poorly as compared to what we are presenting here today. Thank you, Chairperson. Then I'll come now to my part, which is to the issue from Honorable Committee Member Matibela, whether to say that is this compliance, I mean, is the issue of compensation, is it not a deterrence or a challenge for us? I want to say that with regards to that, Chairperson, the ODIMWA, or the Occupational Disease and Mines Works Act, and the COIDA, both of them fall outside mine health and safety. But, Chairperson, there's no way in which in enforcing the Act in the mining industry or the employees that we can forget about this. Because at the end of the day, what ends up putting or placing the mine employees under compensation is the activities on the mines. And therefore, Chairperson, what we do is that we just make sure we enforce that the mine must comply with regards to not exposing people. But should it happen that people are exposed and at the end of the day, either as a result of an injury or as a result of an occupational disease that was contracted during his employment or her employment there, these, we refer them to the different compensation bodies, the ODIMA or the COIDA. So in that way, a chairperson, I can say that the frustration that we have is that the employees, for example, some of them actually they die without ever, you know, because they still come back to us. They actually come to us, DME, because we try and follow up. Then we would hear that no, there is a build up of documents because this is not there and that is not there under ODIMA or under COIDA. Thank you, Chairperson.
We covered all the questions that were raised so far.
There was a question that you said there's some clarification that we needed from the state law advisors. Can they clarify us on that?
I propose that we, without much ado and further delay, we get into the bill now.
Time is 10 past 12, yeah. Let's get into the bill.
Chair?
Now, wait a bit. Getting into the bill, what are we doing? What is the purpose now? Because we have to be sure that we get to the bill. What would be the purpose of doing that? Are we trying to look at it right up to the end and then looking into the mechanism of adopting it? Is that what?
That's our understanding, Chair. So it will take his direction from here.
But if it's like that, we need to have a quorum.
Okay.
We have to ensure the quorum that we are correct. Honorable Lucas, he has just gone out, but he said he is coming back. I don't know how after how long. How many? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So we must be 8 at least. Let's just find out. Call Honorable Lucas back here. Okay, Marcelo.
Now, Chairperson, I had thought that if you take it from the last meeting that we had, certain things were raised. I was hoping that for now they will give us the responses on those. And if we're all happy, then we go back to each and every clause for approval. Now, I'm just worried if we cannot continue. And we say we're going to start from each page, yet we had a few areas that we had highlighted in the last meeting that was in the next room. That was the last time that we met. That probably we'll see how they fitted in those issues. And if we're then happy, then we can be able to have to look into each section now and see how it looks like.
That's actually how it's supposed to be. That they made sure, because as it is written here, I can see that, see here, underlines means those are insertions. So if we are, they can tell us that this is what they've done in terms of changing this whole thing, then the committee itself, when it has a quorum, it goes from the first page, clause by clause, making sure that we tackle everything. And as we go in, we adopt every section. We say this is an agreement in terms of the wording, the letter, the omission, or the commission, then we adopt it up until we close it. If there are reservations by opposition, etc., they can indicate that you can note the objection of this body, etc., but it doesn't stop us from moving forward. Thank you.
Yeah, I think that is why I was asking, what are we, if we say we're coming now to the bill, what are we doing, what are we aiming at? Because for instance, there are many things that you have suggested here that have got to be included and changed, which, I mean, this bill that they have will not have that, which we have suggested. There are many changes that we have proposed here already.
They did make the insertions. The changes we effected yesterday.
No. I'm talking about today now. Today we've talked about COIDA, what are the compensations, what should be done. They haven't done that. These are the things that came from now.
No, I want to explain that, Chief. That document that they were explaining, COIDA, and, you know, that was a documentation for motivation of what is the wisdom of this and that. In compensation, this is how they motivate for it and and this is how we work on it. But that is actually arming us as a committee to have a background in terms of the bill. It was just an understanding. But the bill itself, it captures issues which we said that there were omissions, and they've decided to make insertions yesterday. So that is why they worked up until 1 o'clock. In the morning, this morning. So that is why, that is actually my understanding. That is why I was insisting that if we can go through it today, there's no point to delay, because they have made the additions. Because the issues we discussed, that was a preliminary discussion to arm us with the conceptualization and the idea on how the department works on issues.
Comrade Chair, I think it's necessary that we hand over to the department for them to present as to how they've undertaken the concerns raised by us in the last meeting, including probably them indicating that no, today's presentation has brought this up, that we think here you've armed us, I think we think we necessary to change this. For instance, the issue of submitting training, if they find there's something that needs to be done there, they can propose it down and say, no, we think this needs to be changed. Because definitely, just to submit training without any proof that who was trained and there is a signature to that, or the attendance register attached, then it's not sufficient. That's why I'm saying, if they get the opportunity, let them tell us as to how they've addressed our concerns from the last meeting, to add what we've discussed today. From the, and that would not be meaning that we would be going clause by clause. They'll just go to the specifics which they feel needs to be sorted out. And immediately thereafter we'll take a cue as to what would then have to be done. If there is a need that they need to go and change certain sections, we'll only be discussing that at that time.
That is exactly how I thought it should be done. Because we have raised issues in the last meeting, we've raised issues now, and the issues we have been raising now, they are new, some of them, and so they are not necessarily incorporated, therefore. And we need, when we go through the bill sentence by sentence, to have all those things already inserted, you see. And so that is why I thought that we shouldn't rush to finish when we are going to produce more irregularities, and that will confront us when we are alone. We don't even have a quorum. Yes. So I think, therefore, Your Excellency, please take us through, as the member has suggested, how you intend responding to the input that have been suggested. Even today, yes. And then we agree, therefore, that probably you can go and insert them so that after lunch, then we take us through bit by bit. If you can be able to then put all what is input, then after lunch you can then go through point by point. Right?
Lunch is not going to work. That's it's booked for until 1 o'clock, and some
I don't understand, because I do not understand why the secretary put it only for 1 o'clock, because we have said that during this period we will be finishing these things. But if that is myself, I don't have a problem. We can then postpone it for next week. It doesn't matter. Myself, I'm well and available at any time. But I think we must develop an altitude of workaholics. We must finish things and be able to, you know, going up and down, it's not a very easy exercise. I mean, we will have to postpone now, probably to something that could take only 2 hours, and we are finished, and we know that we have put this aside. But it's fine, because the secretary put just decided to put it in the way that we must finish at 1, and it's fine. Well, let me hear from what.
Now, Chairperson, I think the time will tell. If they present, maybe it will just take about 10, 15 minutes, and we might find that we've got consensus. But immediately thereafter, it will be a matter of incorporating those amendments and agreements into the final draft, of which then it would be a matter of going clause by clause. It will depend on whether we find that we could be able to do so within the specific time. But I think for now, let's say that time will tell.
And we can't, because they need to go and redraft this whole thing and put it and insert all those clauses. It can't happen, therefore, for today, if we are finishing at 1. It can't happen.
This is the problem here. The problem here is, as long as you consume systems, they are not going to finish. These systems are getting confused. You see, because this morning, this draft for me, it was necessary, but it was for information. The main business of the day was supposed to be to concentrate on this. And the reason why we called the state law advisors, it was to advise us on that issue. Because now we say there are going to be new insertions, when in the last meeting there were insertions. And this is why I was saying emphatically clear that the reason why this team did not sleep, it was making sure that they fill everything up, such that when we deal with the draft, we can look into clause by clause and make sure that those insertions cover all the issues we are concerned with. But if this is how we want to work, it's fine. Next week, we are going to be faced with the same problem, because this is where the issue is. Because we thought we would go until 1 o'clock today and finish this thing.
Okay, I think we'll do it the way we have suggested here. We'll just take us through we'll just finalize the issues, and we are going to insert the issues that have been agreed upon now, and we'll continue with these things next week, because this is exactly how we think things are. Just tell us how you intend incorporating all what has been suggested today. And in the last time, of course, most of some of the things that were said last time when we met, I think it was a week ago, you've put them there, and then there are few that we've just also highlighted now in terms of closing the gaps, in terms of what the members have suggested today. And for you, then, when we agree how you are going to do it, then we agree, therefore, that the next week you'll come with a clean bill which has got all those infections, and then we go through it slowly and adopt it.
Deliberations, we have amended
of the Act that deals with training to require that employers keep the record of formal training in respect of employees, the training that is given in terms of Section 2. It's on page 3 of the presentation. And I mean, technically, we're quite happy with that amendment, having taken into account the comments that came through, and we think it will help us address the issue of training. Section 13 on page 4 of the bill focuses on the appointment of occupational medical practitioners. Previously, when the Act was promulgated, we were using general practitioners to deal with aspects of occupational health at mines. And we're just amending the Act to allow qualified medical practitioners to deal with issues of health and obviously notification of the DME of the doctor's appointed to deal with the issues. And then Section 17 on page 4 also deals with the exit medical, because people working at mines, when they terminate their service, they need to go through exit medicals to determine whether they do not have occupational illnesses and thus qualify for compensation. And in the current legislation, there's no time limit to when the exit medical must be done, and we set in that phrase that says within 30 days of the termination of employment, the medical examination must be done. And then Section 20, this was a new insertion, it was not gazetted, but the suggestion there was that if an employee is declared unfit, then the employee cannot be dismissed until the appeal processes have taken their course. So we've inserted that section. I think there was a subsequent one which was making that dismissal unlawful and linking it to Section 87 of the Labor Relations Act, and we've taken advice with the state law advisors, and probably they can help us with a comment there on that section.
Collective bargaining, to issues of discrimination and things like that.
But I think if we have a provision where they rephrase it to say something to the effect that an employee lodging an appeal under subsection 1 may not be dismissed on grounds relating to unfitness to perform work pending the outcome of the appeal. So that basically gives protection, I think all the protection needed to that employee. So that, but the reason why we also limited to the grounds of grounds relating to unfitness to perform work, because say for example, if an employee is lodging an appeal regarding unfitness to perform work and the employee commits other matters of misconduct, for example, and then you're going to find your hands tied, you can't dismiss the employee because there's an appeal. But that's why we related specifically to grounds relating to unfitness to perform work. But even if you look at other legislation, we did a search on other legislation that has been passed, and we found that they, lots of it provides that an appeal, that the decision won't come into effect pending the outcome of the appeal. So I think that is basically ample protection for an employee in that respect. And the thing is, this unfair dismissal, the Labour Relations Act stipulates the grounds in that, and I think that this provision will basically, as my colleague has said, will basically cover those concerns. Thanks.
Section 98, it was also a new insertion that provided for the minister to promulgate regulations dealing with mine rescue services. Because currently we do have regulations, but there's limitations with regard to what mine rescue services does, and we think that that will help to improve the services that are provided in case of emergencies. And then Section 55D is related to the fines to issue guidelines, and those guidelines really deal with the details of how you deal with different types of operations, including small-scale mines. And then the fine itself, there was a lot of discussion. In fact, the last deliberation really centered around the issue of fines and its quantum. And I think we've spent a lot of time with the stakeholders and understanding their inputs. And in the end, we increased the maximum fine from 1 million to 2 million. And
didn't we say last time, didn't we agree that monetary punishment may not mean any impact to the mining magnates, because they have that money. But we must add something else, which is a measure that will make an impact, such as stoppages, kind of stoppages until the matter has been addressed on something related to that. You remember that we discussed that money alone can be a solution.
We had that discussion, and the slide where we presented what DME does and the justice system basically highlighted the different enforcement tools, and one of the stoppages is one of the tools we use in securing compliance. So it is there. This specifically just deal with the fine regime itself, but the stoppages are included in Section 54 of the Act. And then Section 55E, that's the section that we had deleted previously, but with the public comments, there was a call to include it. We've included the section, and I think Shelley commented on it earlier, because this is the section that created a lot of problems when it comes to appeal. And then from subsection 3, we had deleted the sections that were creating problems. And really the background to the whole admin fine system is that in 1997, when the Act was promulgated, Section 86 had a clause that really went against the constitutional tenet, because it said the employer is guilty. If somebody is injured or die at the mine, the employer is guilty until you prove otherwise. And the legislation was passed without that section on the basis that it was unconstitutional. And then stakeholders had to engage and come with an equal with a section that will give equal, be a good sanction to encourage compliance. And given that the legislation was developed in a tripartite environment at the time, also there was a push, I think, mainly from the employers to make sure that, you know, issues relating to what you need to consider are inserted in the Act, the procedure which they currently use to appeal endlessly, and that's what we were seeking to remove and really streamline the processes. We think a guideline will help to a greater degree, because the more you come across problems, it's quicker to review the guideline and really allow you to deal with the enforcement issues. And then broadly, I just looked at the key sections. I think there are four key sections that I think we've spoken about Section 20. There were comments from the public, comments around the amendment of Section 72, and Section 72 did not just make reference to COIDA and other legislation, as we have seen that they are administered by different departments, but basically it was making the inquiry report in terms of Section 72 usable under COIDA to effect the quantum of payment of compensation. We had asked advice from the state law advisors who will comment on that, and also Section 86 that deals with prosecution. And the observation really we want to make is that the current legislation makes enough provisions for us to refer cases for prosecution. There are problems with the justice system. It's important to note that. The problems are not necessarily with how the legislation is crafted. It's the ability of the justice system to process cases. There was a suggested insertion, which I think the state legal advisors will deal with. And then the last section was 55C. 55C talks, the current amendment to the legislation talks about the uses of fines. And this fines, it says they will be used for promotion of health and safety. And from public comments, there was input that were itemizing what you can use that fund for. And we've also taken advice on that one. The state law advisors would just give comments. And the last section being 23, a procedure to get out of dangerous working places. There was a suggestion there that we prescribe ministerial regulation. And I think that we will look at including, although we really feel that Section 98.1F caters for that, because that whole Chapter 98 of the Act is the section that empowers ministers to develop regulations. And our feeling is that it's really adequate to deal with the matter. Nonetheless, the feeling is strong that we can do it, although we think it will be a duplication. But those were the key issues, and I think the state law advisors will advise us on the other issues.
Sorry, Chair, if you can, maybe we'll go through what we quoted. If maybe anything else you need us to advise on, you can just point it out to us. Okay. With regard to the determination of employees' liability, I think that was one of the issues raised. We also looked at a submission made by the National Union of Mine Workers. And then we've also looked at other legislation and to see how they catered for a similar or the same provision. And we found that if you look at the example that they have in the Liquor Act of 2003, they basically speak to imputation of criminal liability. That basically means attributing blame or crime to a person. So basically what this provision, if you look at Section 36 of the Liquor Act, can I just read it quickly? Okay. Which says that if a manager, it basically mirrors what the National Union of Mine Workers Submission said, but I think it just makes it a bit more clearer with the wording. If a manager, agent, or employee of a person commits an offence by performing or omitting to perform an act, and such performance or omission would have constituted an offence, had it been done by the person, that person is equally guilty of the offence if the act or omission fell within the scope of the authority or employment of the manager, agent, or employee concerned. And the person either convinced at or permitted the act or omission by the manager, agent, or employee concerned, or did not take reasonable steps to prevent the act or omission. For the purpose of subsection 1, the fact that the person issued instructions prohibiting an act or omission is not in itself sufficient proof that all reasonable steps were taken to prevent the act or omission. I feel that what this section basically does, it actually casts a net wider enough so that you can't just say, it wasn't me, it was maybe someone else or someone who was taking care of that. So it's basically provided for vicarious liability. So basically the I'd say the owners of the mine or the people in charge can't be absolved from liability. So they will have to shoulder liability in an event of whether an act was performed or an omission of an act which had to be performed. And that was raised by the National Union of Mine Workers, and it actually just covers that also, I think, to quite a broad extent.
I haven't been able to understand each other. I don't know, members have understood exactly.
No, Chairperson, I think the biggest problem is it's a long phrase. From this time that she was reading, I've even forgotten what did she say, because you need to link your starting statement right to the end. If it could have been there, maybe we could be refreshing ourselves to understand. I'm not sure that she's reading the proposal from NUM or she's already quoting from another piece of legislation that covers NUM. I think also with you that I'm not sure as to what is happening.
But she was quoting from a Liquor Act, which is she similarized to the question of a point raised by NUM. That therefore this act on Liquor Act is formulated the same as the question that NUM raised in terms of the protection of the employer to a place for poor performance, which they refer to that there must be a Labor Relations Act kicking off, if I'm not mistaken.
Imputation of liability. But I think the issue is that, from the public comments, NAM has made an insertion on Section 86. And I think what the state law advisors are saying is it's better packaged in the Liquor Act. And that's the example they were giving us. That probably that's what you can use. Because the input that we got was we battled to understand it. And one of the standards of draft in legislation is that it needs to be clearer. So they did research to look at where you can find similar insertions, and that's where they find it, which is much clearer.
But to us it's not clear, that's what we're saying. That is what we have. Let's allow Comrade Honorable Tukan, you are the first to raise your hand, then
You see, what will help with the state legal advisor is that you don't just read a quotation. You read it and you expand on it. You say, look, this is what it to us, I mean, we are not lawyers. You just say to us as politicians, look, this is, you summarize it as, this is what it says, and this is how we can use it for the act. And it becomes clear whether you say yes, Director Sinaman will be liable in case of a disaster that you think is caused by negligence or not. But you need to be very clear as advisors, as legal, state legal advisors, exactly what you say after reading that quotation. The second point that I want to make is that, look, indeed, as you say, Chief Inspector, that you need to look at other acts and see where this has been applied before. Don't you, in your research, also look at the international scenario? You know, in South Africa, whatever we do, we like to say, this is world class, this is according to international standards. So it can be international standards when it suits certain conditions and not international standards. I mean, if in Britain they are liable, in America, third world countries, they are liable, then they must be liable also in South Africa, unless we are saying life in South Africa or in Africa is subhuman, is inferior. And I'm saying we are the only people who can protect our own lives here. If we're making it inferior, then the first world will be too happy. When they invest in their own country to respect human life, but when they invest in Africa, which is what has been happening, to treat us like our lives are inferior. So if it is international and they are doing it there, that is another precedent that we should use, not just our law, because their constitution has been long. I mean, human rights, democracy there has been non-existing. We only started 1994. I'm just saying, also international standards should be used. And have you made that research? Thanks.
No, Chairperson, I think it would be more easier if the state law advisor would say, we concur with NUM, or in terms of this bill, we think it's necessary that that should be incorporated, but we suggest it to be incorporated in this way. Or if they are saying that no, you'll find satisfaction in the Liquor Act, that means nothing will be written. Now, it's very rare that you start looking at all the other acts. I can understand if it could have been maybe labor relations. It's rarely, it could be easy to look into, but I'm hoping to understand. Are they saying they are agreeing with NUM that there is a necessity for that provision, but it cannot be included in here? That means there could be no amendment. That should be found in the Liquor Act. They must look at the Liquor Act when they are to take that issue. I think they want to respond. Let me just give them the opportunity, because they might even just give us.
Yeah, not for now. Let's listen to what Tim Lefay is saying. Maybe he's coming with some other useful info.
Sir, I'm still battling. You know, when it comes to cost surplus, Section 20 in particular, the illegality as raised by the state law advisors with regard to that cost surplus as suggested by the National Union of Mine Workers, if perhaps they could. Because in some instances we have had this cross reference, but I didn't get them very clearly as to how would it be illegal. Because they are saying then it would therefore mean that we would be amending the other act, the other piece of legislation. But lastly, Chair, just on what Danny was saying in terms of international standards, the Chief Inspector himself was saying the other day that the other minister was asking him why these companies are killing people outside South Africa, but in South Africa they are killing people. Perhaps a direct one to the Chief Inspector. In terms of this amendment, how then are we responding to that question? Which clause is responding positively? Is saying no, we are now stopping
these companies from killing these people.
Yeah, let's hear you do what the state advisor has. Clarification, please.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Can I just start with the last question that the Honorable Member asked? In terms of Section 24.2 of the Occupational Health and Safety Act, that section covers the powers that the inspector can in terms of the stoppages and the cordoning of where an accident has
happened. What does it say? We do not have it dictated to us. Let's see what it says.
In the event of an, in fact, 24 starts with the, report to inspector regarding certain incidents. Now, 24.2 says, in the event of an accident in which a person died or was injured to such an extent that he is likely to die or suffered the loss of a limb or part of a limb, no person shall, without the consent of an inspector, disturb the site at which the incident occurred or remove any article or substance involved in the incident therefrom, provided that such action may be taken as is necessary to prevent a further incident, to remove the injured or dead, or to rescue persons from further danger. Now, that section speaks to the issue that members have been raising about. Now, what happens, because usually an accident will occur, but then nobody has to take care whether that place is cordoned off or complete dysfunction of that place is made. So I understand that section to be talking to that concern and covers that issue. Now, coming back onto the question of...
They are still continuing.
Thank you, Chair.
The concern was not necessarily when we deal with stoppage for a week or so. We don't, you see, a scene of crime, naturally you make sure that there's no interference. Yeah, but now we're talking about using stoppages as deterrence in cases of non-compliance. So that's not exactly the point she's raising. So that's why I'm saying she should not understand that way, because she's narrowing it down to a scene of crime. That's not what we meant by saying that there should be deterrent, such that in an event the owners don't comply, they should know that the department can take actions such that it inhibits business from functioning. It should be business, not business as usual. Become business unusual.
Yeah, what the member is saying is that whereas what you have been reading is about a scene of accident that is cordoned off, but here we are talking about some kind of a penalizing effect of stoppages. Not only does it cordon off, we simply that if the it means that this accident happened because there was actually poor standards. So we then say there will be no work for, say, 1 month until we are sure that these standards have been improved, you see. Not that we only address the scene of accident, but we also address the standards that have led to the cause of that accident. That is what the member is saying, and that's what the committee is saying, that we will use stoppage. In fact, this is what the other provinces have used to improve that, because fines have been too tedious and bureaucratic. They have used stoppages as penalties to make this company comply.
Thank you, Chair and Honourable Member. We've noted that we will work on a draft of something that will mirror exactly what the committee is saying, and then probably then have a clause that talks to that issue on the amendment bill. On coming to the point of Section 187 and Section 20, what we said is that Section 187 of the Labor Relations Act, it outlines and clearly says these are the grounds where if an employer does A, B, C, D, that automatically becomes unfair dismissal. Now, what we have stated before the committee is that Section 20 says, that is Section 20 of the Principal Act, it says, it outlines actually what happens once the employer has done whatever is necessary in order for them to come to the conclusion that this employee.
We're talking about the Liquor Act and all the relevant thing. Now we are going to 20, which we are aware that they will respond to. We haven't finalized NUM's reference. They just
it's not addressing that.
Chair, there are three questions that were asked, and I'm talking to all of them. I started with the last one that the member started with, which was a question on the issue of the cordoning off and stoppages. And then the second one, the member said he was not clear what we said about the unlawfulness of 20 and 187 reference. And then the last question was that of NAM suggestion and what we are saying. So I was getting to all three questions as been asked.
I'll protect it.
Thank you, Chair. Now I'm still on Section 20 and 187. I'm saying 187 outlined to us what are the specific grounds that if an employer does anything out of all those grounds that are mentioned there, it is automatically termed as unfair dismissal. When we look at Section 20 of the Principal Act, it says the employer does whatever they do and then they declare the employee unfit to perform at the mine. And that gives them a reason to let them off and take them out of the employment. Now, if you look further at that section, it then says the employee who has been declared unfit to perform can appeal. And the suggestion was that on that appeal, we should take it further to say once an employee that has been declared unfit to perform because of the illness or whatever, once that employee has filed an appeal, that appeal should stop whatever other process pertaining to his dismissal. Until the appeal is finalized, that employee cannot be dismissed. And now, there was a further suggestion to take that section to say, if that dismissal does happen, then the suggestion is that it must be made an automatically unfair dismissal in terms of 187. And what we are saying is, as I've already clarified, 187 specifies the grounds. And this Section 20 does not fall within those grounds. But what we are suggesting is, make that appeal stop any further process with regards to dismissing that person until the final outcome of the appeal either concerns what the employer is saying or concerns what the employee is suggesting. But we cannot make the reference to 187 of the labor relations.
Very clear. Yeah. Right. I think, therefore, did you have something more?
There is one last one, Chair.
Oh.
Now, coming on to the first of proposed Section 86, new insertion of Section 86. NAM has made a proposal
Continue.
Now I'm on the proposal of the insertion in Section 86 of the Principal Act.
So, what is
by NAM. In any prosecution of an employer or a person contemplated by Section 2A, 3 of an employer, or any person contemplated by Section 2A, 3, 4 of the Act, for an offense in terms of subsection 1, or for culpable homicide, proof that the act or omission of the accused caused death, serious injury, or serious illness constitutes sufficient proof of the offense, unless evidence is adduced that the accused was not negligent. An employer commits an offense if the employer has failed to comply with a duty in terms of Chapter 2, and as a result an employee dies, is injured, or becomes ill, or the health and safety of an employee was seriously endangered. If any prosecution in terms of Subsection 4, it is not a defense that the employee's death, injury, illness, or endangerment was caused by the act or omission of an individual. Proof that the death, injury, or illness was due to the employer's failure to comply with the duty in terms of Chapter 2 or any act or omission by the employer is sufficient proof of the offense, unless evidence is adduced that the employer did what was reasonably practicable or took reasonable steps to comply with the relevant duty. That's the proposal. Now, firstly, the problems with that proposal. It talks to the process in court, that is prosecution of the person. The proposal as given by NAM, it talks to the criminal procedure. It talks to the criminal process inside court, which we are saying is not to concur with them and not to accept this proposal. We have the Criminal Procedure Act. We have the processes as to how the court deals with finding evidence and admitting evidence that they will use to make a finding. Now, to say that if internally within the mine it has been proven that a certain employee caused the death of other employees, that automatically becomes proof that the employer must be liable and responsible for that criminal liability. We are saying our systems as they are does not allow that. And we cannot concur with the proposal as submitted by NAM. And the suggestion that my colleague was reading is then a suggestion that looks at accommodating the idea that we believe they had in coming up with this proposal. And it talks to the proper processes and talks to the proper legal system that must attend to that question. And it says, if the suggestion that we were coming up, then it says, if it's found that an employee did not perform or did perform, but then that performance or that omission caused the death or caused the injury that was sustained by the other employees. But the employee did that because the circumstances as the employer is required by the Act to have made them to be conducive for those employees. The employer failed to do that. Now, because of the failure of the employer to provide a conducive environment for all the employees, the fact that this was done by the employees will also be attributed to him as the employer for failing to provide a conducive environment. And that is all that we are suggesting in the new proposal that my colleague read. It covers that and actually then talks to that problem. I don't know if I'm clear and have answered all.
So we can, if you make a formulation, such that it explains exactly what you're saying, then we can perhaps look into the merits and the demerits of that. Maybe because it's suggested by NUM, we can also ask you to further make a consultation so that we come back and we deal with it that way. So your proposal in session, which explains exactly what you are explaining to us, and then you collate that with what Noom expects to happen, and from there you read it back to us when we have an opportunity, such that we can make a consideration and a determination.
Now, Comrade Chair, I think this is now in the hands of the committee and the committee alone, understanding that there would be an advice. But I think on the other hand, we need to make it a point that the remarks and the presentations made by the stakeholders, we try to, if it seemed to be going to help the process, and it will help us decrease the carnage, it needs to be considered. My worry is, now I can't even compare the two. Probably if we could have the copies of what Noom has recommended and what they are recommending, and look at the two and see whether is it getting very close to each other, for us to say, no, we're happy. Because the one that they are recommending, I think they've got a recommendation which is getting close to what Noom has proposed. But now it goes back to the same thing that I'm saying. If we're not provided with something in writing, it could turn out to be something else when it comes as a finality, unless we could have something to see. I can see there's something on the board now. I don't even know which is that one. Is it the proposal from Noom? Is it what they are proposing now? I'm mixed up to make a proper comment.
Honorable Mahlaba, I said they must first read what Noom says. They read that first. And after that, then they read what they think it should be like, because they said they do not concur with what they read, which was a submission from Noom. So it is another thing when you say you want it in writing, but they did read it. You see, they started by reading it, and then they then came with their version. And so what we can then say is that they must provide us with their version and the version of Noom, and we look at it as a committee. Because that is the bill now is before the committee. We need to look at what Noom says, and we need to look what they say. And we as a committee, we need to take a decision.
Chairperson, I think we are on the same page. Because if we go out today after one, would we say which one we've agreed upon? Because that's what I'm saying, that we need, so that it can be included, so that when we come back on page by page, it's already there.
As no, we're not going to do that now. There is no page by page today. It has been agreed that at 1 o'clock we finish. We'll see it next week. So what they are going to give us is Noom is going to give us their version. They are going to give us their version. We will digest them over the weekend, or we can look at them now and agree now.
Yes, that's what I'm asking.
Yeah.
That's what that's all.
That before we leave, we agree that this is the version we're going to adopt, so that when they go and tailor the new amended bill, it has got that version. I think that is what should happen. So can you give us that version of yours so that we consider it now before we adjourn? Let's allow the state law.
Didn't get my suggestion, Chair. Comrade Mahlaba, you didn't get my suggestion. Precisely because you thought that we have to complete the matter now. I said that two versions are on the table. The first one is what Noom is, and the compromise which the state law advisors are giving us. And it's written here. See? Yeah, it's here. It's there.
No,
they
say it's
numbers. No, relax, man. Please, learn to be patient. What is this you say? See, I'm saying NAM has a point. But what the state law advisors are saying, they have modified and NAM's version by actually making an emphasis on the employee. You see, the employee causes an accident, so that another employee dies, or is injured, or loses a limb. You see that? So they say, if it's established that the conditions which made this employee to cause an accident which affected another employee are actually a proof that the employer did not create conducive conditions, then in that way they can make that compromise and that insertion. That's all. So what we say is that they give us the version of NUM and the compromise, such that we will depend on whether that compromise is also acceptable by a stakeholder. If there is that compromise and it's unacceptable, then that can help this committee to come up to a determination, which determination will be an insertion in this amendment of the Act. So this is exactly what I say. Just saying that we give them time to work out that version of theirs, because it's a compromise. So that when we come on Tuesday, we work on that new compromise, and from there we go on adopting it. That's the suggestion I'm making, Comrade Mashlava.
That's the thing to say, law advisor.
Chair, I just want to clarify one thing also. With regard to the NUM submission, all this relates to Section 86. It starts with that. NUM also proposed imputation of criminal liability, but the first part which they propose into Section 86, we say it can't be possible because of the Constitution. The Constitution is supreme law of the land, and if you look at what this submission is essentially saying, just to basically summarize what my colleague has said, is that you're interfering with the powers of the court. When you look at a criminal matter, you know in civil matters you have to prove on the balance of probabilities. In criminal matters, you've got to prove beyond reasonable doubt, and you're innocent until proven guilty. Now it's those basic legal principles that contradicts this first recommendation by NUM in terms of Section 86. That one, and also when it says what you can use as evidence, what you can't use, there's already laws providing for that, and many of those things we can't decide beforehand. It's left for the courts to decide. So when we legislate that, we're interfering with the domain of the courts. We're interfering with the jurisdiction of the courts. And there's certain things where we know where to stop when we legislate, and there's other things which we can't, which is left to the constitutional framework. So we have the Criminal Procedure Act, we have the Constitution, which provides the onus of proof, the evidentiary rule of evidence, all those things. So we limited and stipulated here. This will basically infringe someone's right to a fair trial. It will actually limit their right to a fair trial. And that's why we're saying, in terms of the second proposal of 86, that we can take on board, and that we basically just change a few words to modify the second proposal of 86. But the first proposal is that it will interfere with the jurisdiction of the courts. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. Just to add on all that has been said, and actually to clarify in terms of the process and the way forward now, I agree with what the Honourable Member has said with regards to what the way forward now and what is expected of us. I also just wanted to add that from this discussion now and the indication from the members that we have had, we are now, as the state law advisors, are actually going to prepare the A list, which will be the amendments that have been spoken to and have been proposed and the members have been deliberating on. And then on Tuesday, that's the document that we're going to be talking to, the A list that we will have prepared, which tries to catch up everything that the members have been suggesting and have been proposing today. Then that's the document that's going to be before the committee, and I will look at it and look at the bill. And if they are happy with that document, and then that's the document that's going to be adopted to then go further to the printers and the committee section to give us the B bill version, which will be the bill as proposed by the portfolio committee after all deliberations. Now, that's the document we're going to work on, and it will be ready for Tuesday. Thank you.
I'm not sure, when are we getting that on Tuesday? Their proposal? When we are in a meeting? Like when we are in a meeting? I was trying to check if it was
through. The procedure is, they will bring the document, and we go through it now, sentence by sentence, isn't it? So, because because it will be having, or if any of what was suggested is not there, then it means it is still not complete. But they are going to capture all what we have suggested here as amendments, including the compromise legal version of what NUM was saying. So we'll go through even all that. So it is up to us whether we accept it as they will have proposed it the way they have explained it now, or we don't. So because the bill is before us, we can do anything about it. So it's not a problem. It's not a train crash. You wanted to sleep with it over the weekend?
No, I'm not saying over the weekend, but I was just thinking if we were to sit with it, maybe if one could get it. I thought there was a possibility that you could get it, say, by Monday or what. But if you are saying Thursday should be on Tuesday, that's fine with me. But
the problem is that you can say that if you are alone, you may be, because it may only be you who is here on Monday. Maybe members will come very late in the evening on Monday, and then they'll only come to sleep for the meeting on Tuesday. Still the same. So you must say what you want to say, but don't talk on behalf of members, because the meeting is on Tuesday. And so just say that you would like to have the COP on Monday, so that you get it on Monday.
Chair, that would be fine with me if I have it, say maybe before I come to the meeting. But there was the last thing that I wanted to check.
Well, I agree with them, then I think because it will be ready by Monday for Tuesday. So lies with them that they give you a copy by Monday yourself. And whoever else wants it on by Monday to sleep with it, they can talk to them. But the formally, that is a document that will be here in the committee on Tuesday. Yes. don't wreck us now, because your option has been
No, yeah, the first one, yeah, I think I'm covered.
Yeah. So however, you have the second one.
Yeah, there was this thing. You see, I think the first response with regard to what the inspector was saying. Yes, we talked about the stoppages.
Honorable members, can we give? You are becoming a little bit noisy. We can't hear the member now. So can we give him a chance to make his statement? Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just saying, when we have had an instruction for the mines to be audited, so because of the carnage that we have had, in relation to the question that I raised to say, as the inspector was saying, chief inspector was saying, he was asked, why are these companies killing people in your country? Are we saying, as proposed in the amendment bill, that is enough, that would stop the mines from killing people? I mean, I heard the response that there would be, the areas would be cordoned,
honorable member, let me again bring guidance. I don't know, maybe there was a time that you went out here. Probably that is when we dealt with this matter. You see, what we have done here, we have said to them all those things, especially that were raised by you and an honorable law, that they must be captured here in the best way. Because remember, if they are not captured on Tuesday, we find that they have not been captured, we will still reject the bill, you see. So they have agreed that what you suggested and what Honorable Lord suggested about making sure that we close the gap about all the bureaucratic processes that have been there to make these acts unbinding or delaying. We have said that those gaps should be closed in accordance with what the committee suggested, and they said they are going to do that, and the state law advisors are going to work with them in doing exactly that in the most constitutional and legal way to present this bill to be constitutionally acceptable. So they'll bring the bill here on Tuesday, having accommodated all that, but we will still go through that bill sentence by sentence, to see that it has got all that. If it doesn't have, we'll return it to them and they'll have to include what they did not include.
I'm covered.
See?
Yeah. Chairperson, you'll recall in the last meeting, the chief inspector made an example of a meeting that he had. I'm not sure that it was in Australia, but internationally, where he was asked as to why is it that your mines are killing people, yet the same people who may have mines here, they are not killing the people. Now, the honorable member was asking that question as if there could have been one size fit all, there will be one response in the bill to cover that one. He was asking us whether, is this bill now responding to that question that was asked to the chief inspector, that he made an example here in the last meeting.
Exactly, that is what I'm saying.
And if you remember the issue of cordoning and all those, it was trying to respond to that question, but it was not relevant. To me, it was a matter of this whole amendment is seeking to advance more stringent laws to deal with such carnage. And it was in that context that.
Like, that is what you're saying. It is exactly like that. That is what we have agreed that they are going to do. And we will go through it on Monday, I still repeat, I mean on Tuesday. We'll go through all that. If they have not done what we have said, if they have not done what you have suggested and agreed about, all of us, if they have not done what Honorable Law has said and we have agreed about, we will return it to them. So I do not think that they see that there is any controversy about it, because they have not said they are not going to do it. If we still had an argument with them, we would then suggest another meeting on Tuesday, which will go through that argument until the argument is solved. But they have agreed with all what we have raised there that they are going to do it. Likewise, the controversy was between NUM and their Virgin. Now, the state law advisors have advised how they are going to make a compromise, legally constitutional phrasing of that, which we are going to see on Monday. If again on Monday we feel that it is not satisfactory, we can still return it to them and it be done in the way that is satisfactory to all. So I do not think we have to now track ourselves on that. I think we are agreed about all those categories. Yes. Yeah.
Chair, one point I want to make, from a practical implementation point of view, we've investigated the changes that we thought would be necessary. Some of these are new inspections, and from a technical implementation point of view, we're going to look at them from that perspective. If they are workable, we're happy. But if they are not, we will be very clear on that matter, because we certainly an implementing structure, and we will obviously advance our case if it's practical to implement. I just wanted to make that point to the committee.
So on Monday, I mean on Tuesday, therefore, I think before we go through this bill, you must come and tell us before we start that we could not implement this and this and those suggestions, so that we don't even waste our time in starting to going through the bill. We iron out and agree what exactly they say. So it means, therefore, because what we are agreeing about is that we are on Tuesday, we will be finalizing this bill. And when we finalize this bill, it is when we have to go through it sentence by sentence, you see, clause by clause. And if we do that, you must also bring the principal bill. The principal bill, the amended bill, and the clean bill, which is now clean. So that's what we need on Tuesday. If at all you feel that you must note where you could not address this concern and say, we felt that we can't do this, we felt that we can't do that, then we will therefore open up again a debate so that we find common ground with one another. And that is all that we can do. And if it needs be, then we will tell the committee section that this bill is not agreed upon, so it can't be passed this year, this term. It will be passed maybe in another new term of new parliamentarians in 2009. You see, because we also have deadlines when to submit this for NCOP deadlines. So if it did not go through on the 23rd in the National Assembly, then it is dead. It's a dead debate. It means we're wasting. wasting time all along. So let me listen what the state of what was wanting.
Just one point of correction and clarity on the point you just made. We will have the A list on Tuesday together with the old bill that we were looking, but a new bill that incorporates all your things we will not have, because it will not be done by the printers, but we will have the amendment list of all the amendments. So it will only be the A list, which is the proposed amendment, which once you have agreed and you're happy with, will then be adopted. And once adopted, only then can they go into the bill. And then only after that Tuesday meeting can you have the new bill version before you with all your amendments as the committee. But on Tuesday, it won't be before us, the B bill version.
But on Tuesday, we will be able to adopt the bill and then it will be go to be cleaned as a new bill, isn't it? Okay, so it will be ready by then for being presented to the National Assembly. Okay, right. Okay, I think at that level, thank you very much. I think we've come to the end of the session for today. I wish everybody a safe journey back. We will meet on Tuesday. So, which means, now before we close, which means there will be therefore slight changes next week, because we had planned that we will have a study group on Tuesday at 2 for radioactive waste management bill, and therefore have the waste management bill deliberated on, therefore, or finalized, if at all, on Wednesday. That was our plan. But it seems now we will have to meet on Tuesday morning for this bill. And then after lunch have the study group. So there is just an extension. We will meet at 10 for this bill, 10 to 1, and then at 2 we will meet in the study group for looking at the radioactive waste. And then on Wednesday we will deal with the radioactive waste to finalize. Right.
No, Chairperson, it's very obvious that means on Tuesday we need a quorum. And it talks to those who might be in other committees, that if they could bear with us and be here on Tuesday. I think that is important to say, take into account that there are those who are knowing minerals only on Wednesday.
We agreed, honorable members, that we will be able to be here on Tuesday for the purpose of passing this bill. The group is not here. Yeah, but anyway, so we must be here at 10 on Tuesday. The secretary will arrange the venue accordingly. Thank you very much, therefore. I think this meeting is adjourned.
Chris. Jesus. Jesus. Where's the tape?
What's that, Jim? Where are they? I often just leave it and come back. Is that yours?
No, okay.